Nuclear tone deafness at a criminal level. What's more American than football? Not what we Americans call soccer, but the rah-rah, toss the pigskin, kick a field goal football. And where's a better place to play a pickup game than in the middle of Nagasaki, only 5 months after the atomic bomb we dropped there killed more than 70,000 people. But it's worse than that. When you learn from a genuine expert who did the research to locate the football field.
The field was, in fact, right in front of a middle school that had been destroyed by the bomb. And I think the total was 162 students and teachers were killed at the school. So the field was literally a killing field. You can see goalposts on this field and the blackened shell of the school. And then little details like they decided they could only do touch football and not tackle after they found all these glass shards on the field itself from the bombing.
Well, when a journalist, documentary filmmaker, and expert on Nagasaki reveals how American soldiers romped and played on what was arguably the site of a nuclear crematorium, you get yet another perspective on how we've been trained to frame that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine, keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who would like to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with author, journalist, and filmmaker Greg Mitchell. He's director of the award-winning documentary Atomic Cover-Up, and he's talking here about his latest film, The Atomic Bowl, Football at Ground Zero, and Nuclear Peril Today. You're not going to want to miss this one. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Linda Pence Gunter with a very special nuclear hot seat hot story, Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuke Resister with another story from our shared history of successful activist resistance, and more honest nuclear information than we will ever get out of Elon Musk. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, May 27, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out this week in the U.S. with a look at the recent rush of rulings on nuclear emanating from the White House as Trump unleashes 5 nuclear executive orders that, while reckless and dangerous, are also total fantasy. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with the necessary perspective in this week's very special, very hot nuclear hot seat hot story.
Last Friday, a day that will live in nuclear infamy, President Trump unleashed, his favorite word, 5 new executive orders focused on the nuclear sector. With a stroke of a pen, he rolled back nuclear energy policy about 50 years and set us on a path to certain disaster. Collectively, the 5 orders reduce and undermine the already limp authority of the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission, fast-track unproven new reactor projects without regard for safety, health, or the environment, impede public intervention, and reopen the pathway between the civil and military sectors, all while putting nuclear power expansion on a dangerous and utterly unrealistic accelerated timeline. Trump, who seems to treat executive orders like a Nike slogan, "Just do it," has commanded that the U.S. quadruple its nuclear energy capacity by 2050. This will be achieved not only by expediting the licensing of small modular reactors that are still designs on paper, but also by accelerating the license extensions of the current reactor fleet out to 80 or even 100 years, and, quote, the reactivation of prematurely shuttered to partially completed nuclear facilities. 10 new large reactors with complete designs will be under construction by 2030, one order announced. 3 pilot project reactors shall be approved by the Energy Secretary with, quote, the goal of achieving criticality in each of the 3 reactors by July 4, 2026. In case we need reminding, that's just over a year from now. It's a pace with zero precedent in the nuclear sector and with zero likelihood of fruition. Also ordered is the facilitation of, quote, 5 gigawatts of power uprates to existing nuclear reactors, which comes with its own set of safety concerns given the age of the currently operating nuclear power plants. The Secretary of Energy must also designate at least one site for advanced reactor technologies within 3 months of the order and ensure that it will host a fully operational reactor there, quote, no later than 30 months from the date of this order. These utterly unrealistic deadlines will be achieved by gutting the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and circumventing annoyances like the National Environmental Policy Act, with which some of these projects won't be required to comply. The NRC needs dealing with, says the White House, because it has been engaged in, of all things, a deliberate act of, quote, throttling nuclear power development. If only. DOGE will soon be visiting the NRC to fire people, after which it is expected to stop interfering with things like safety standards. All this does is guarantee another major nuclear accident waiting to happen. Despite titling one of the executive orders Restoring Gold Standard Science, gold being another of Trump's obsessions, and I'll have more on that next time, they of course do anything but, especially when it comes to health. Dismissed is the linear no-threshold model for radiation exposure, which basically means that any increment in radiation exposure, no matter how small, increases the risk of harm. Also rejected is as low as reasonably achievable, a radiation safety principle that guides minimizing radiation exposure. Those models are flawed, concluded the sound scientists in the White House. This will open the door to advocates of hormesis, who, without any firm basis in actual science, golden or otherwise, insist that a little radiation is good for all of us. The line between the civil and military sectors is significantly blurred in several of the orders, most notably in the frequent references to the resumption of reprocessing, which separates out the uranium and plutonium in irradiated reactor fuel, while producing a vast amount of so-called low and intermediate level liquid and gaseous wastes that are released into the air and sea. Reprocessing was long rejected in the US because of its obvious nuclear weapons proliferation risks. All of this madness was ushered in by a press release headlined, President Trump signs executive orders to usher in a nuclear renaissance, restore gold standard science. Just in case there was any confusion about what this meant, the press release included an explanation that read, gold standard science is just that, science that meets the gold standard. So glad they cleared that up. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
In other news, in eastern Washington state, the Hanford site made the plutonium for U.S. atomic bombs and left behind vast amounts of highly radioactive waste that must be dealt with, but that nobody is quite sure what to do with. Residents have long spearheaded an operation to deal with 56 million gallons of nuclear waste left behind in dozens of underground tanks, some of which are currently leaking. A cleanup is expected to cost $500 billion and may not be completed until 2100. However, several dozen staff, who reportedly include managers, scientists, and safety experts, have taken early retirement or been fired as part of a broader governmental reduction overseen by Elon Musk and his Department of Government, quote, efficiency, end quote. The changes have thrown the communities around the Hanford plant into limbo. Those raising the alarm include politicians from both parties, environmental activists, and indigenous communities who have historically owned the land on which the 560-square-mile site sits. U.S. Senator for Washington Patty Murray said workers are already understaffed and that cutting further positions was, quote, reckless, end quote. In California, Pacific Gas and Electric has been told to pay back customers $43 million for a retrofit mistake that was made at the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. This according to a new regulatory ruling that blames the utility for lapsed oversight of the project. According to the decision by two administrative law judges, PG&E's failure to properly oversee a $130 million retrofit of the Unit 2 generator back in 2019 allowed leaks and excessive vibration to build up during the 2 years after the work was done. The ruling, which now must go before the state's Public Utilities Commission, would force the utility to pay back customers the $43.2 million cost of replacement power while the Unit 2 generator was shut down for repairs in February of 2021. NASA scientists have rediscovered an abandoned U.S. nuclear base buried beneath Greenland's ice sheet since the Cold War. The site has been identified as Camp Century, a military outpost built as part of Project Iceworm, a secret Pentagon project which aimed to build nuclear missile launch sites beneath the ice that could target the Soviet Union. Partially constructed in 1959 during the height of the Cold War, Camp Century was abandoned in 1967 as Greenland's shifting ice sheet was too unstable to support the envisioned underground network of ballistic missile launchers. Today, the base lies entombed beneath at least 100 feet of ice. And the pro-nuclear lobbyists who are working on the state level have certainly earned their quarterly bonuses. Two announcements in the last 2 weeks. New York Governor Kathy Hochul is making a major push to not only build new nuclear plants in New York State, but to make New York the center of a nuclear revival in the U.S. According to Mark Dunley, chair of the Green Education and Legal Fund and long leader on environmental issues in the state and nationally, said that Governor Hochul has, quote, bought into nuclear power. She buys the argument that nuclear is carbon-free, avoiding looking at the life cycle of nuclear and its carbon footprint, which includes significant emissions of carbon in uranium mining, milling, enrichment, fuel fabrication, and at other points. Quote, the nuclear industry has been lobbying her to go along with it, and she has. End quote. And in Massachusetts, Governor Maura Healey proposed to repeal a law put in place by voters as part of a worldwide nuclear freeze movement. This is a bid to open the door to greater deployment of newer nuclear energy facilities, which notably have not been built, which of course means they can't be tested, and there aren't even any approved designs. But sure, Maura, let's ignore what the voters wanted and give the nuclear industry free rein while parroting their pre-written focus group tested talking points on the citizens of your state. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, with so many worrying things going on in the world, why do you need to think about nuclear as well? Because radiation released from the entire nuclear fuel chain, from uranium mining to manufacture, nuclear reactors, weapons, and waste, will last in human lifespan terms forever. The decisions made now, the actions taken now, will have consequences beyond our imagining. If we want to avoid our descendants, we should be so lucky as to have them, screaming back at us through time, what were you thinking? Attention must be paid now, while there's still time to do something. And that's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat, to keep you up to date on not only what's going on with the nuclear industry and the governments that back it, but what you can do about it. Every week, we bring you the kind of nuclear information that mainstream media just doesn't seem to have the heart or time or money to put on the air or in print. Our stories have been sourced, checked, footnoted, and then we add interviews with genuine experts on the nuclear industry. We also tell you about the triumphs and challenges of activists on the front lines around the world. But we can't keep doing this without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations and cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from this show, now is the time to help us out. Be it a one-time donation or a monthly recurring gift, With any amount, you'll be supporting the services required to keep this program running. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Director Greg Mitchell is an award-winning journalist and author of a dozen books on United States politics and history of the 20th and 21st centuries, including The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, Hiroshima in America with Robert J. Lifton, and Atomic Cover-Up. His film Atomic Cover-Up, released in 2021, won the Best Archival Documentary Award at the International Uranium Film Festival and is still available on PBS. We'll have a link to it at the end of the interview. Here, we talk about his latest film, The Atomic Bowl, Football at Ground Zero and Nuclear Peril Today. It's about a big deal football game that was played in Nagasaki between U.S. military members only 5 months after the atomic bombing that killed more than 70,000 people. It's currently being screened at the International Uranium Film Festival in Rio and will be released on PBS in July. I spoke with Greg Mitchell on April 18, 2025. Greg Mitchell, it's great having you here with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Always happy to be here. Thank you.
You are an amazingly prolific writer and filmmaker. In addition to your articles, books, and films on such topics as political campaigns, protests, media manipulation, and human justice issues, much of your work has been focused on nuclear. What started you in this direction and this focus?
You know, of course, I grew up in the 50s during the duck and cover days. You know, I was in grade school and all that. But I became really taken with this issue probably, I mean, I kind of realized I was being taken when I went to see Dr. Strangelove when I was in what we called junior high school then. And I was totally blown away, so to speak, and just loved it. And I had a friend that for years we quoted lines of dialogue back and forth and so forth. So although Dr. Strangelove was darkly funny, the message also had to stick with you. It was always my favorite movie going forward for decades, really. If they said, what's your favorite movie? I would still say Dr. Strangelove. But then, you know, other issues kind of intervened. You had the Vietnam War, which I was very active in, you know, protesting. And then we got into the 70s and there was various Nixon CIA related issues and numerous other activist things. Then we had Three Mile Island in the late 70s, which is, of course, nuclear, but, you know, not nuclear bomb, although related. And then in 1982, and I think we've probably talked about this before, of course, we had the real rise of the freeze movement. I was living in New York City. Of course, we went to the June 12th rally. And like everyone was interested and fascinated. And if you were an activist, you kind of really wanted to get involved in this wonderful anti-nuclear movement, which had all sorts of cultural things, which I loved. You know, I was always kind of a film person and rock and roll person. And art, and with the rise of that anti-nuclear in 1981, 1982, just tremendous outpouring of very clever art and fun art things, films. Of course, the Atomic Cafe came out in 1982, the film, which a lot of people saw, and again, a mixture of kind of darkly funny and darkly serious things. So I became really totally energized in that issue. And then I met a fellow in New York who became a focus of a lot of my work later, Herb Sassan, who was one of the people who shot footage in the only color footage in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 and 1946, and helped write and assigned and published the first major story on that whole. And by then I had become the editor of Nuclear Times magazine in 1982, which had just started, and became the Bible of the anti-nuclear movement, a national magazine that really was written and published for activists all over the country. It was very popular for a few years. And so from 1982 to 1986, I was the editor of Nuclear Times. So, of course, I was very involved in the issue again. And then in 1984, I got a journalism grant to go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki for a month, which again sort of changed my life because very, very few people, maybe to this day, journalists get to go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki for a month. Generally, they go for a couple days or a few days. So I was in Japan for a month, came back and wrote numerous articles, et cetera, et cetera. So my path was kind of set there. Even though I left Nuclear Times, I then wrote a book with Robert J. Lifton called Hiroshima in America, which was a very popular and important book. And I've written two books since then, and now I'm directing films the last 4 or 5 years. So it was really that key period in the 1980s, which kind of built on my lifetime of interest in this subject.
Your 2021 film, Atomic Cover-Up, is, in my estimation, one of the most important films that we have because it tells an unvarnished truth. We get to see what Hiroshima and Nagasaki looked like in the immediate aftermath, or as close as we can get to the immediate aftermath of the bombing. And then we hear voices from the camera people who are actually shooting this material.
Yep.
For those who have not yet had the privilege of seeing Atomic Cover-Up, give us a sense of what the film consists of.
Well, I mentioned Herb Sassan earlier as one of the people who shot this footage in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so he is part of this film. The other half of the film was talking about the Japanese newsreel team, which shot the first black and white footage and the historic black and white footage from just the first few weeks after the bombing for several months after. This footage was then confiscated by the Americans and disappeared for decades. And the color footage, which was shot by a U.S. military, elite U.S. military film team, was also buried for decades. So that became that the story I mentioned at Nuclear Times, kind of took the lid off that story, and then I kept returning to it. So ultimately, I was not a filmmaker then. So I wrote articles, I talked about it in books, and so on and so forth.
So it was known that the footage existed, but it just wasn't accessible, or was this a rumor? It was known, but nobody could get their hands on it.
Well, a little bit of both. Again, we can distinguish between the black and white footage, which was shot by the Japanese, which was seized by the Americans, and did disappear. The Japanese, of course, some Japanese knew about it, but they couldn't get their hands on it. And it took until the late 1960s when Japan successfully got America to find and return this footage, which had been buried in the National Archives or in the Pentagon for all those years. It was then finally sent to Japan, and they started to be able to make use of that to document. You know, we've all seen, starting in the 1970s, this black and white footage. It tends to be the same bits of it, even though the Japanese shot 3 hours of footage. But a lot of these black and white images that you've seen over the years come from this footage. You know, Americans couldn't see it, and the Japanese couldn't see it all that time. So finally, that was released, even though the full story of how it happened, which is in Atomic Cover-Up, talks about how the Japanese producers and the creators of the original footage hid reels in the ceiling in Japan from the Americans. And they turned over, allegedly, all the footage, but they kept some copies in the ceiling. But even then, they were prevented by the U.S. occupation from doing anything with it. And the Japanese government didn't really want them to do anything with it because it was so controversial to the Americans. Plus, Japan wanted to move on. I mean, you have to remember that there was a faction in Japan that also wanted to downplay Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because any mention of Hiroshima and Nagasaki brought up the war. And Japan, of course, feeling they were accused of starting the war and being horrible war, war monsters themselves, wanted to downplay all that. So that's the black and white footage, which eventually said came out. The color footage really wasn't known at all. It was shot by this American team, dozens of hours of footage sent to the Pentagon and then hid in various archives for decades. And it really took Herb Sassan speaking out about it to draw attention to it. And our, you know, frankly, our article in Nuclear Times had a lot to do with publicizing the fact that now it was at the National Archives and it had been declassified, but no one knew the existence of the footage. So it was just as if it was still classified. You know, if you don't know something, you know, it's hidden. So starting in the mid-1980s, filmmaker started using some of the footage. But again, it tends to be, if you've seen the color footage, the same images used over and over, probably because it's cheap, probably. It's been copied before, and you just copy the copy and so forth. So what I did, I mean, all those years when I was not a film director, I always imagined making a film using this footage, because I had a VHS copy of every bit of the footage. And I would look at it sometimes, and I would actually imagine, if I got to make a film, how would I open it? What would I use? And what could I do to make it look very creative and gripping and everything else? So I kind of partway had it mapped out, you know, in my mind. So I finally got to do that starting about 5 years ago.
What is remarkable about the film is not just the fact that you have this footage, which is available in other places under other means, but the narration that goes with it, that you have used the words and recreated the comments of not only the American who shot it, but also the Japanese man who shot the footage. Right. And tell us how that came about, what you had to do to get that audio.
I had interviewed Herb Sassan, who I interviewed and knew very well. Daniel McGovern, later Lieutenant Colonel Daniel McGovern, was the head of the project, the film project. And I also had interviewed him several times, and he also had done some oral histories and things like that. So he had talked about, not that anyone knew about any of this stuff, but he had gone on record with a lot of this stuff. So I had sort of his words, Herb's words I certainly had, and the Japanese men, several of them who shot their footage or was the director of their footage, some of them had talked about it, but only in Japanese. So I paid for the first translation into English of their stories. And the one person who's kind of a hybrid is a guy named Harry Mamura, who's a very interesting character. He was a Japanese man, cinematographer, who actually shot Akira Kurosawa's first film in the early 1940s. He came to the U.S., and I think he'd already been in the U.S. and worked on films. And then he was back in Japan at the end of the war. And so the American film team hired him to be one of their chief cinematographers. So he shot some of the most beautiful, some of the most striking footage from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the raw footage. And I made use of a good deal of it. And it turns out he had written a memoir that had never been translated into English. So I drew on that. So this film is really certainly the first full story of this film footage, but it's also the first ever told firsthand, totally firsthand. The entire film is firsthand accounts. So you not only get the images that these people shot, and you not only get the story of the cover-up and the suppression, but you also get these firsthand accounts. I was there, and I saw this, and we went there because of this, and I had to turn off the camera because this person was suffering too much, and I couldn't shoot it. You know, there's one scene in the film. There are actually several scenes in the film that I'd been told about that this footage was shot, but I never saw the footage. But when I got my hands on the footage, I could see, for example, there's a story about the head doctor at a Red Cross hospital in Hiroshima, who was filmed with patients on the roof of the building. And, you know, they're displaying their horrid burns and wounds for posterity. Sort of, this is what an atomic bomb can do. And this is what this brave doctor had to deal with. And so the people sort of show their wounds and burns. And then at the end of the scene, the doctor takes off his shirt and shows the camera that he's got these horrific scars on his back and stomach. He was hit by flying glass. So this is one example of something I was told was captured, but I've never seen it, never been used in film or anything like that. So I got my hands on this footage, and then I used it. So in Atomic Cover-Up, you see the same. You show some of the people who are showing their wounds, and then the doctor takes off his shirt and shows his. That's an example where there was so much footage to draw on that no one had ever seen, even though it was declassified. And so I was happy after all these decades to finally get some of what I think some of the most important footage on the screen.
What has been the path that the movie has taken since you released it in 2021, and what has the feedback been?
Well, it's very gratifying that it did get chosen by over 20 festivals around the world, some very, you know, major ones, and, you know, from Hawaii and San Diego to Berlin. It's won several awards, and, you know, just last year it won the top prize from the Organization of American Historians, the leading group of historians in the country, won top prize for film and TV. And it won several other awards, and it got picked up by PBS. And in fact, I believe it was renewed on PBS a few months ago for PBS.org. So anyone listening to this, unless things change between the time we're taping this and when it airs, if you go to PBS.org and put in Atomic Cover-Up, you'll find what was a shortened version. The PBS aired two versions. One was the feature length, which was 52 minutes, and one was the shorter, you'll call it a short version, 28 minutes. I believe they've put back up the shorter version, 28 minutes, which I believe any of you can view if you wish.
Have you perceived or been told about any substantive shifts in policy or awareness or action as a result of people having seen this film?
Well, I can't say that. And I guess the larger, and you've certainly done everything you can to draw attention to this issue. And I frankly don't know what your opinion is over the Oppenheimer film and the result from it. Now, when it was about to come out, I was invited to one of the first preview screenings. Christopher Nolan was even there taking questions. And I immediately started a Substack newsletter related to the film and Oppenheimer, which grew very popular very fast. And I wrote daily critiques of the film and just history related to Oppenheimer, history related to the film. It wasn't all every day I was like writing a review, but every day I posted something about it for several months. And I sort of, when I saw the film, a lot of people were saying, this is going to set off a new anti-nuclear movement. It's going to be like the early 1980s. And, you know, this is going to, you know, change the world in a sense. And I was very skeptical from the start, partly because, you know, the film itself. And to my mind, even though there were some good immediate things that came out of it, including more attention for the downwinders and various, you know, lawsuits and congressional bills, a couple other things like that. There was some good in that first month of frenzy over Oppenheimer. There were some positive things. But long term, I think, as I feared, there hasn't been that much of a movement type response, even though, as you know, movement remains active. There's a lot of great things going on, a lot of strong actions happening, but not related to Oppenheimer film, movie, I don't think. So it's a lot to ask for a 52-minute documentary to also do that. But the fact it was seen by a lot of people, especially when it went to PBS, and even, like I said, even now people can watch it. And who knows, there might be 10 people will watch it now and, you know, start some kind of national action. So I'm very happy about that. But we have not stopped the renewal of the arms race, all the new nuclear threats. I've had to sadly post on my newsletter, Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, moving the hand a little closer to midnight and all those kind of things. The rise of AI, the new threats of AI and so forth. So we still have a long way to go.
Now you have a new film that is coming out, The Atomic Bowl, Football at Ground Zero and Nuclear Peril Today. That's a nice summary. Tell us a little bit more about what the film is about.
Well, this is another case of something I became aware of probably 20 years ago. I might have mentioned it in one of my books, you know, in a paragraph. I was just totally fascinated, but no one had really done anything at length about it. No one certainly had done a film about it. It was just some people knew about it, you know, a few people knew about it. And what it is, and again, this kind of mixes, I'm also kind of a sports fan and a fan of dark history. But what happened, the bare outline, which is all anyone knew, was on January 1st, 1946, on the day when we, especially back then, all of the football college bowl games were played. including the Rose Bowl and everything. A really, really big deal in America, January 1st bowl games. And on that very day, on the same day in Nagasaki, they played the American all-stars from the U.S. occupying military, played the Atomic Bowl, what was dubbed the Atomic Bowl in Nagasaki, with these some all-star players, including one who was a famous pro all-star and the recent Heisman award-winning quarterback from Notre Dame. So this was not just a bunch of guys taking a football out of a locker and, you know, hey, let's form a couple teams. And this was well covered by the media. It was quite a big deal at the time. And the fact it was played in Nagasaki just several months after the bomb, most of the media didn't seem to bother them at all. It was just, oh, here's a bowl game in Nagasaki and, you know, et cetera. So it was kind of, I don't want to say sexy, but it had a great media hook to it, you might say. And there it sat. You know, it was covered for 2 or 3 days and mentioned in like a sentence or two in, you know, one or two books. And I, like I said, even I knew about it. I even mentioned it in a book. So, you know, a couple of years ago when I was thinking about my next film, I'd done two other films since Atomic Cover Up, which were also aired on PBS. I came back to this and I said, this is an incredible thing, you know, an incredible subject. I feel like I still have at least one more Atomic film to do. And so I started researching it to see what images there were out there. Was there any footage? What do we know about the players? Where was the game actually played? Where in Nagasaki? Why was it played there, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how this started. And then as I found out, there were some images that people had never seen, and there was no real footage per se of the game, but a lot of images that you really never seen the light of day. And then we can get to the firsthand account by an American poet professor who really provide the only full firsthand account of the game, which I found and used exclusively in the film. But just to point to one angle was I found that anyone who had ever said anything about this or knew anything about this bowl was always like, well, it was played in Nagasaki on this field. Don't know where and so forth. So through a lot of research, I was able to nail down that the field was in fact right in front of a middle school that had been destroyed by the bomb. And I think the total was 162 students and teachers were killed at the school. So the field was literally a killing field, and it had been cleared by rubble, so it was flat. They put up two goalposts, and I actually found some footage from that suppressed American color footage we talked about earlier. You can see goalposts on this field and the blackened shell of the school. And then little details like they decided they could only do touch football and not tackle after they found all these glass shards on the field itself from the bombing and other things. They said, okay, we can only play touch football. So that's where they played. So it's not only the fact they played in Nagasaki, but on an actual, what I would call a killing field. And so the film went on from there, you know, where I was more and more gripped by this every day. I did research. And so now the film, like Atomic Cover-Up, is now going to air over PBS starting in July. And there's a 52-minute longer version and a 29-minute shorter version. And PBS stations will have the option of using either doing a half-hour program or a full-hour program.
It's a horrifying, ironic, deeply disturbing set of images that you are explaining here about this action taking place when and where it did. And it's a very powerful film that takes this football game that's supposed to be light and entertaining, but puts it in a context that shows how, at minimum, tone deaf it is. Now, you're talking about this starting on PBS in July, but before that, it is going to be screened at the International Uranium Film Festival in Rio de Janeiro in May. They're actually going to be screening both of your films, Atomic Cover-Up, which won a major award, the top award from the festival a few years ago. And is this going to be the first screening of the Atomic Bowl in front of the public?
It's just started going to festivals, so this will, unless something happens between now and the end of May, this will be the first screening.
You going to be down there for it?
Well, I'd like to be. It's a long way, not to dwell on me, but it is. I was surprised to learn there's no direct flights from New York to Rio, which is kind of shocking to me. So it makes for an enormously long flight, so I have to ponder it a bit longer.
Well, the caipirinhas on the beach are really worth it.
Okay, thank you.
Now, let me ask you a personal question because this is obviously very intense information that you're dealing with, intense images, the words, putting it together, and you're living in the middle of it. How does this affect you, and what do you do to get through it if it does at times depress you or you find yourself
Yeah.
slipping down the rabbit hole?
Right. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I've been going through this for 70 years, if you go back to the mid-50s. So I'm used to, in a sense, I'm used to it. I've gone through all the day after on TV and Threads, and you may remember the War Game, Peter Watkins' famous War Game, when I was still in college. That was all the controversy. And Peter Watkins showing what would happen if the UK suffered a nuclear disaster, and the survivors stumbling around, very controversial at the time. So it's been a long time for me, but I guess because I always keep hoping and working for a positive outcomes and a turnaround in the arms, whatever you want to call it, build up regime, nuclear threats and dangers and so forth. And that's why in this film, I guess it's another obsession of mine has been Nagasaki, partly because I went there, spent a number of days there, which most people don't. They get to Hiroshima and that's it. And because I always felt Nagasaki was the forgotten bomb. Certainly the people there that I interviewed and met where I was there was, it was like, no one cares about us. No one cares what happened here. We're number two. Always number two is always. So I've written many articles going back decades about Nagasaki, trying to write that balance. So I was especially happy to do this new film with its focus on Nagasaki, because when you think about it, or when I think about it, the lessons of Nagasaki in some ways are stronger than the ones from Hiroshima. I know Alex Wellerstein, the great nuclear historian, wrote for The New Yorker, which I show a screen of this in the film. Hiroshima will always be preeminent because it was number one, but Nagasaki actually may have more importance for us today. And among the reasons for that is, and this is like the last third of the film focuses on this, the lessons of Nagasaki. One is the fact that, and this is too much history to go into, but just in a nutshell, it was sort of an accidental, in a way, a bombing. The President Truman never gave explicit orders to do it. And the bomb was used sort of casually. It just came off the assembly line. So it was a little too easy to imagine this happening today, especially with AI, where basically a set of things happens and, oh, gee, we used a nuclear weapon. Okay. And then another reason is the fact that, not unlike Hiroshima, where there were at least, estimates vary, 15% of the people killed were military, in Nagasaki, there were literally only a few hundred non-combatants. The other 80,000 or 100,000, whatever number you want to use, were all non-combatants, mainly women and children, elderly. And there was no thought given to this. It was just like, well, we know there's no big nuclear base there. We know there's no, and the bomb was off target besides. But there never, it wasn't like we were not bombing in the military base by any calculation. And so again, what do we see today? We see this surge in civilian casualties around the world in wars, whether you're talking about the Middle East, talking about Ukraine, talking about Africa, a real troubling surge in the killing and the targeting, really, of civilians. So again, without dwelling on this, Nagasaki shows this in spades. And there are various other things about Nagasaki that are important today. So in any case, I was very happy to be able to draw attention to Nagasaki. People can make of it what they will. But the fact that this football game was played in Nagasaki really gave me a chance to do both things. Again, go back to this history of America not coming to grips. I mean, I guess that's been my theme going back to when I was at Nuclear Times. America not coming to grips with its use of the bomb, where today people still defend it. And that the fact that we can still defend Nagasaki makes it all too much easier to use the bomb again. Because if you can defend that, you can find reasons to defend future use or use this weekend, who knows? Anyway, that's what you ask me what drives me, and I guess it's because I always hope to show light in dark these dark corners that have been suppressed, forgotten, media not caring, pro-bomb propaganda, you might say.
With this being the 80th year since the start of our atomic nuclear nightmare, my presumption is that anyone who is so closely identified through your work with this issue would be on the call list for journalists coming up on the anniversary. What does your next several months look like? And have you been deluged with questions, or are they basically ignoring you like they want to ignore the bomb?
Well, as we speak, it's a little early to do. We're not into July or August yet. So I always hope that there will be a coming to terms. In the 50th anniversary, 1995, when I wrote my book with Robert J. Lifton, which got a great deal of attention, as did many other books in that year. 50th anniversary, I'm sure you remember, it got, you know, cover Time and Newsweek cover stories, and every network did the specials, and I don't know how many books were published. So there was, you know, I would say there was an attempt to come to terms and a failure. You may also remember the Smithsonian controversy, where the Enola Gay exhibit was suppressed at the Enola Gay was displayed, but all the exhibit around it, which went through the history of the bombing, was suppressed at the Smithsonian in 1995. So that was a symbol of how actually we didn't come to terms with it at the 50th anniversary. So I had hopes, well, maybe the 75th anniversary. And that didn't really happen. That's, I guess that's 5 years ago now. And so now we're at the 80th. Now, I don't know. This people may see this as the last major sort of semi-major anniversary. People who from World War II are almost all gone. And we're several generations of young people who may or may not even know where the bomb was dropped or why. So anyway, I would hope the 80th anniversary could be a big deal for raising issues and raising attention. And I hope that happens. When I was raising all these issues about the Oppenheimer movie, I did get quite a bit of attention because there weren't that many people doing it. I mean, that showed that there was probably identified as a kind of a potentially hot subject. And here's a way to talk about it with someone who's kind of a critic who can, from his perspective, bring this argument forward. And so I hope that that at least happens.
What's next for you? And is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, I don't have another project going right now. Like I said, I did four films in 4 years, some of them overlapping. Like I said, I've written about 13 books. I never didn't think I would become a writer director of documentaries, but it happened. And so I'm basically we'll get through the next couple months and then see what I want to do after that. But I'm paying a lot of attention to this film. I want to draw as much attention to it as possible, because sometimes you only get one chance. So, you know, I guess I'll go all out on this film and then see where we are this fall.
Well, we will certainly do everything we can to help people continue to be aware of it here on Nuclear Hot Seat. For now, I want to thank you, Greg, for all of the incredible work that you have done through the years to open our eyes to the truth about Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the bombings, and the tone deafness of America when it comes to that. And I want to thank you for being my guest again this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Okay, thank you.
Award-winning documentary director and journalist Greg Mitchell. We'll have a link up to the 29-minute cut of Atomic Cover-Up, which is posted on the PBS website, but you can get there most easily by going to nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 726.
Activists, shout out.
It's time to grab your milk and cookies, because now we're about to have another story from our collective activist past. There's something about a train. And in the early 1980s, anti-nuclear activists from coast to coast turned that truth into a successful campaign that literally drove the bombs off the rails. Here's Jack Cohen-Joppo with this month's Nuclear Resistor story.
Ever wondered how nuclear bombs get where they're going? Not to their targets, but from the factory to the bases where they're stockpiled and deployed. In the early 1980s, activists in Washington State at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action learned that a special set of railroad cars was delivering nuclear warheads to the naval base Kitsap Bangor for loading onto the then-new Trident ballistic missile submarines. The bombs rode the rails from the Pantex Warhead Assembly Factory in Amarillo, Texas, to bunkers at the Kitsap Bangor Base on Washington's Puget Sound, and to the East Coast Naval Weapons Station in South Carolina. Each train was centered around a few armored cars holding the deadly cargo. Buffer cars and escort cars topped with gun turrets for the security team were added to each end, and you couldn't miss them. They were painted all white to keep the contents cool. They ran the same routes as commercial trains, but no faster than 35 miles an hour, slowing even more when they passed through cities and towns along the way. Ground Zero consulted with railroad buffs and reached out to dozens of peace groups along the likely train routes. Together, the Tracks campaign began to document each shipment with photos and video, sending word down the line to the next group who would alert the local media and protest the doomsday cargo rolling through their town. The Catholic Bishop of Amarillo and the Archbishop of Seattle both endorsed the campaign and enlisted the public support of nearly a dozen other bishops along the tracks. A Mennonite volunteer from Colorado moved to Amarillo to keep a prayerful watch and alert others when the trains departed, and soon there were vigils greeting the trains in more than 300 communities along the rails between Pantex and the nuclear submarine bases. The nuclear train that left Pantex in late March of 1983 was the first to meet nonviolent resistance. In Colorado, two men were busted trying to stop the train in Denver. 60 miles on in Fort Collins, 8 people, mostly teachers and parents, were cleared from the tracks and arrested. And 6 more arrests were made when the train confronted 200 people outside the Bangor Gate. Over the next 18 months, 5 such trains each provoked multiple blockades, leading to the arrests of nearly 400 people across 8 states. Several people were jailed for a day or a week, while a few served 2 or more months in jail. When one train tried to avoid protest hotspots and take a longer route over the Rockies to Bangor, it still encountered nonviolent resistors in rural northern Montana at both Conrad, population 2,500, and Whitefish, population 4,000, where dozens had turned out to protest. When the next train to Bangor took the same route, 3 people blocked it in Whitefish. One man was sentenced to 5 days in jail and furthermore ordered to report back to jail 24 hours before the next nuclear train came through town, where he would be held until it passed by. By then, the train had been repainted in earth tones to, quoting a 1984 memorandum, make tracking our trains more difficult. But the transport of nuclear warheads by rail was doomed. Trains just can't avoid what or who lies ahead on the tracks. In the tradition of the Plowshares movement of direct disarmament, that point was hammered home on July 16, 1985, the 40th anniversary of the first atomic bomb test. After proper placement of railroad hazard warnings, Richard Miller used a crowbar to remove 2 rails from the tracks leading out of Pantex. Miller riddled, "What is the difference between Pantex and Auschwitz?" And answered, "At Auschwitz, the trains carried the people to the crematoria. At Pantex, the trains carry the crematoria to the people." 3 weeks later, in a secret document dated August 6th, Hiroshima Day, 1985, and later released under the Freedom of Information Act, the government confirmed, in all caps, that the nuclear trains would be sidelined, quote, "in view of the growing anti-nuclear movement in the United States with its apparent focus on the white death train." Since then, a custom fleet of tractor-trailer trucks with armed escorts has been hauling doom on the nation's highways. Their appearance in turn sparked the H-bomb truck watch, but that's a story for another day. For now, this has been Jack Cohen-Java for Nuclear Hot Seat, hoping this story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives will inspire your activism today.
There's a really interesting Zoominar coming from the Nuclear Waste Scholars series. It's called Cute Drawings of Terrible Things, Nuclear History Through Comics, and asks, can comics help us better understand the places, people, and impact of uranium mining, nuclear testing, and weapons production? B. Aaron Cole, an historian and artist, will talk about how graphic history and memoir tell the stories of nuclear history and landscapes in compelling and engaging ways. They'll talk about their work on the Nevada test site, Project Plowshare, and Rocky Flats, and discuss the challenges and opportunities of doing nuclear history in comics form. This will be held on Friday, June 6th at noon Pacific time, and you need to register in order to attend. We'll have that link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 726. A heads up for any listeners in New Mexico or who can get to New Mexico for the 80th anniversary of the Trinity Test, the first atomic bomb explosion in the world. It will take place on July 16, and among the participants will be Melissa Park of ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. She will also be attending the 80th anniversary commemorations in Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the 6th and 9th of August. I won't be able to attend, but if there's someone out there who would like to do a news story on it, get in touch with me and let's see if we can set something up. And also from ICANN, Lucero Oriarez, who for 7 years has been the digital campaign coordinator for ICANN, is leaving her position to return to the Netherlands and take on new professional challenges. She has often been a support on the monthly ICANN update, and we will both miss her and wish her every success in her future endeavors. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 27, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. You can sign up by going to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a yellow opt-in box that you just can't miss. Put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get just one email from us, but it will contain the link to that week's show and a short description of its content. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that to us in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount, any, will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, said, the problem of nuclear weapons ends by its use or its elimination. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.